Today at Reader's Corner, Ira Shapiro, author of The Last Great Senate, Courage and Statesmanship in Times of Crisis.
It's much harder to be a senator now than it was 30 or 40 years ago. And the changed media is a significant part of it, even though the media has changed. I don't think it excuses senators from acting in the best tradition of the Senate. I think that the Senate failed the country and failed President Obama. When he came into office at a moment of absolute national economic crisis, he didn't get any cooperation from the minority from day one. That's pretty unpatriotic.
I'm Bob Custra, president of Boise State University. Welcome to Reader's Corner. Ask just about anyone their opinion about politics and the federal government, and two words you are likely to hear in response are dysfunction and gridlock. But today's guest, Ira Shapiro, knows firsthand of an era not all that long ago when big personalities in the U.S. Senate worked together to solve big problems. His book, The Last Great Senate, Courage and Statesmanship in Times of Crisis, details the final years of what he sees as a golden age of statesmanship, when the Civil Rights Act of 1964 and the Voting Rights Act of 1965 were passed. The Vietnam War was challenged, and Richard Nixon was held accountable for Watergate. The book is now out in paperback. Today we're featuring an encore edition of our interview with Mr. Shapiro. A former top Democratic Senate staff member, Mr. Shapiro writes about the making of the Senate's leading figures, including Idaho's Frank Church. He also writes about the lawmaking and policy discussions that were emblematic of the Carter administration to demonstrate how this once amicable and collaborative legislative body worked across the aisle to find solutions. Mr. Shapiro has held a wide range of senior staff positions in the U.S. Senate. He played a key role in negotiating the North American Free Trade Agreement and served as general counsel and ambassador in the office of the U.S. Trade Representative during the Clinton administration. Since 2003, Mr. Shapiro has been practicing international trade law. He joined us today by phone for this interview. Ira Shapiro, welcome to Reader's Corner.
Bob, thanks so much for having me.
Well, Ira, what's the time frame of this last great Senate? If you have to put the dates on it, what's roughly the period we're talking about here?
From my standpoint, the U.S. had a great Senate from 1963 to 1980, and I chose to tell the story of it by focusing on the last years, which were pretty much 1977 through 80. It was the time of the Carter presidency, new Senate leaders, Robert Byrd and Howard Baker, and the 1980 election in which Ronald Reagan won a landslide and swept out a lot of major senators, including Frank Church, shattered that Senate.
During those years, you were serving in what capacity in the Senate?
I was there from 1975 through 87, so I kind of saw it pre-1981 and post-1981. I was working for a number of the Democratic senators who were well-known, Gaylord Nelson, a leading environmentalist, Abraham Ribicoff, a great former governor, Tom Eagleton, who's known primarily for the McGovern fiasco in 1972, but actually was a terrific senator, and Robert Byrd.
One of the things I found interesting about your book, and I was just telling you before we went live with our show here, that I had an opportunity to work for Senator Charles H. Percy from Illinois during this very period you're talking about, especially 77 to 80. And one of the things I noticed was the clubbiness of the staffs and the way the staffs knew each other, worked across the aisle, not just the senators, but even before the senators started working together across the aisle, it was the staff that did that. And in your book at one point, and you just glossed over this, but it struck a chord with me, you mentioned that Senator Robert Dole, who was a pretty strident Republican in his earlier years, hired a Democrat to do, I think he was the chair of a committee where there was going to be some health care legislation. And he hired this woman.
Sheila Burke.
Right.
She disclosed to him that she was a California Democrat with some labor background, and he said, I don't really care about that. You know about patient care, and that's what I care about. You're making a really important point, though, Bob. One of the remarkable things about the Senate that I'm describing here was it was really a demilitarized zone where partisanship was concerned. There were a lot of differences, regional and ideological differences, and fierce battles of that sort, but it wasn't a partisan place. We were always told, Democratic senators were always told, if we had some brilliant idea, find a Republican, because it was recognized that you had to succeed on a bipartisan basis, and if your ideas were worth anything, they would get bipartisan support. There's a lot of reasons for that that we can go into, but it is true that the parties were closer together. There were more moderate to liberal Republicans then, and there was a conservative group of Southern Democrats. But I also think it was just the way they conducted themselves and the way we at the staff level learned what the senators expected us to do.
I can remember conversations in the Percy office where when one of his colleagues who was a Democrat would be running in another state, there would be all of these strategic discussions about how you would avoid going in there and speaking against this cherished colleague who now had opposition. I don't imagine there's too many Democrats or Republicans left in the U.S. Senate today that are going to hesitate going into another state and beating up on the opponent, so to speak, their colleague.
No, that really was a courtesy of the time, and it was part of the way the place worked. You know, the Senate had 100 members. You had to work with people to accomplish things. It was very difficult to do that if you had just come back from being in their state and campaigning against them. I've got a couple of stories in the book that really reflect that. One, I remember Birch Bayh, when he first came to the Senate, Democrat from Indiana. He was quite stunned when Everett Dirksen sat down next to him on the White House yacht the first year he was there. Dirksen, the great Republican leader, also from Illinois, like Senator Percy, except more conservative. And Dirksen started talking to Bayh about what he would have to do to get reelected in Indiana. And Bayh was completely stunned. But it was, to that extent, a club. But it was also a group of people who knew they had to work together. The other story I'll just add quickly, because I love it. In 1980, Gary Hart of Colorado was in a very tight race for reelection. He was a Democrat against Mary Buchanan. And Barry Goldwater had been invited to go into Colorado. And the Republicans were elated that the father of the conservative movement was coming into Colorado at a time when the campaign was up in the air. Goldwater was asked about Gary Hart, and he said, "I think Senator Hart's the most ethical person I've known in politics." And Hart won a very narrow victory, and he attributed it to Goldwater's comment.
To the extent that the media plays and did play during this era a very important role in how the two parties and their leadership position themselves, do you ever give any thought to what the difference is today versus then when it comes to this 24-hour news cycle, these cable shows that have grown so partisan? That must be another factor that makes it a little more difficult for these folks to be agreeable with each other and sit down and work together.
No, absolutely. Bob, I always say, whenever I speak about this, that there's no question, it's much harder to be a senator now than it was 30 or 40 years ago. And the changed media is a significant part of it. We have the 24-hour-a-day media and the ultra-hyper-partisan media that has a tendency to, A, attract listeners who only want to hear one side of the story, and B, attract and kind of force public officials to raise their voices and be more shrill and strident. So I always acknowledge that. The one thing I would say, though, is I don't think it excuses senators from acting in the best tradition of the Senate. People like Carl Levin on the Democratic side, Richard Lugar on the Republican side, have continued to operate like senators, even though the media has changed.
Well, it certainly was interesting the other day to see Senator Bob Dole return to the floor of the Senate in a wheelchair, where he attempted to get his fellow Republicans to vote for the Convention on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities Act. And trying to demonstrate some bipartisanship, I guess, and get support from his party. And of course, that failed. I thought that was a particularly interesting moment, and to some extent anyway, seems to prove your point about the inability of parties to come together, even when one of their most outstanding leaders of the past anyway tries to urge the Republicans to come forth here.
Well, I agree with that. It was both a memorable and poignant moment with Senator Dole on the Senate floor in the wheelchair. It's one thing when senators actually are opposed to something and really believe it. But the truth is, as the press indicated, several of the Republicans who voted against the treaty and defeated it had indicated previous support for it. So they were basically acting simply out of political fear. The Tea Party and Rick Santorum and that part of the party had intimidated them. And that's very regrettable. The senators that I knew and worked with back in the 70s and the 60s earlier, they weren't perfect, but they were quite focused on the national interest. And when all else was said and done, they kind of operated according to Mark Twain's credo, just do the right thing. It'll impress some people and astonish the rest.
You know, we had Senator Alan Simpson in town here a month or so ago. He was actually in here to talk about the Simpson-Bowles Commission and the work that lies ahead for Congress to avoid the fiscal cliff. But I happened to get him off to the side, and we were sharing stories of this these years that you wrote about. I told him that you were going to be coming on to do the show. And he heard I worked for Senator Percy, and he told a story that, again, is so emblematic of what you're writing about here, where the vote was the sale of the AWACS, these jets, to Saudi Arabia. And the Jewish community was violently opposed to that vote. And Senator Percy was from Illinois, where he had a sizable Jewish constituency, which, in fact, would eventually play a key role in defeating him in 1984. But this was earlier than that. And Simpson went to Percy. I never knew this until he told me this when he was here just a few weeks ago. He said, Chuck, we don't need your vote on this bill, okay? You can take a pass. And Percy voted for it anyway. And I can remember back home Percy agonizing over that, but telling us all that it was the right thing to do to keep the balance of power in the Middle East. And he jeopardized his career and eventually lost for a whole set of reasons, but one of which was the fact that he lost the support of that community. And again, it just is a good example of what you're talking about here, where senators were willing to stick their necks out in ways that I don't think they do today.
Well, that's a great example, Bob. And my book, of course, has a number of similar situations where you can't explain what the senators are doing other than the fact that they saw the national interest and they pursued it. In the book, we've got Howard Baker agonizing over the Panama Canal treaties. And, of course, we had Frank Church doing some agonizing as well. Baker knew that if he voted for the treaties, he would never be nominated by the Republican Party for president. Church knew if he played an active role on the treaties, it was really going to hurt him in his reelection effort in 1980. They both did it nonetheless. That's what the national interest, as they saw it, required. It had political consequences, but they did it anyway.
You're listening to Ira Shapiro. He's the author of The Last Great Senate, Courage and Statesmanship in Times of Crisis. While we're on Howard Baker, you also made reference to the Carter Malaise speech. You might want to refresh our listeners' memory on what that speech was. And what I found fascinating about it was the reaction of Howard Baker, the Republican, to that speech. Today, I don't think that would have happened, but please tell the story.
People may remember that in 1979... we had a terrible economy. We had the Iranian Revolution had stopped oil imports coming from Iran. Our economy was going down. There were gasoline lines. Energy prices were soaring. Carter retreated to Camp David for about 10 days to sort of contemplate and talk to people about the nation, and came back and gave a speech about, which has been labeled the malaise speech, although he never really said there was a malaise, but he referred to a national loss of confidence and sort of soul-searching. And Howard Baker and others were supportive of the president. It wasn't that they always agreed with him, but they respected the presidency. They weren't always piling on. Baker said, we really have to work with him on this energy policy. Jack Danforth, who was a younger senator then from Missouri, said, we have to stop attacking the president. We've only got one president. He's not going to be able to do his job. We wouldn't hear anything like that now. The contrast between their behavior and, say, Mitch McConnell, the Republican leader in the Senate, who made it clear that his highest priority was defeating Barack Obama, even while we were in the midst of a national economic crisis, illustrates the decline of the Senate. It's had a 20-year decline, and it's accelerated in the last few years.
You mentioned Senator Frank Church. We have the Frank Church Institute on this campus. Bethine Church is providing great leadership over the years to keep that institute in a center position at Boise State, and it's been a great asset to the university. We've had many people come in and talk at the annual conference. Give us a little background about Frank Church's role during this era, especially in holding the intelligence community feet to the fire as far as upholding American values.
Well, I spend a fair amount of time in my book on Frank Church, because I think he was a great senator and a singularly important figure in the Senate. Many in Idaho know, but Church got to the Senate at the age of 32. He was the boy orator of the Snake River. And even from the beginning, he seemed to be marked for greatness. But one of the things about Church was he operated from very deep convictions. So he was really, I think, the Senate's most consistent critic of an imperialistic foreign policy that he thought the U.S. was following. There were others who were against the Vietnam War, and Church was one of the earliest. But he really, it flowed from his criticism that the U.S. was overreaching and was becoming, forming its own kind of imperialism. Church also was a severe critic of, he had been an intelligence officer, and he was a great critic of the intelligence community, investigated the abuses of the intelligence community after Watergate. So his legacy is very controversial, and I refer to him as at one point as being one of the most admired and reviled men in the Senate, because his critics thought he was hurting U.S. national security and intelligence, and many others thought he was a great hero for taking on these issues.
Now, after the Panama Canal episode and his vote, he decided to run for president. How did the Panama Canal vote impact his run for the Oval Office?
Well, actually, the Panama Canal came after. He ran for president in 1976 when Carter was nominated.
Oh, that's right, yeah.
And the canal came after that. But I think it was rather poignant because I think Church felt that he was well positioned to run for president in 1976, and actually I agree with him. It was a period of time, you know, that the country was disillusioned with government and corruption and Watergate, and Church was really the Senate's leading moralist. He actually did stand for a nation being as good as its people were. And in a sense, he was well positioned, but he didn't start his campaign early enough. And Carter, who had plenty of time to campaign because he was a former governor and he wasn't doing Senate work, Carter was able to wrap up the nomination, running a campaign that probably sounded a lot like Church would have. What happened with Church was he was investigating the intelligence community, and he simply couldn't finish the investigation in time to go out and run for president.
You talk about Jesse Helms' election in 1972, about his political tactics that are familiar to Senate watchers today. What is it about what Helms did that was different and may have set the standard for the way they operate today in the Senate?
Well, I think you're pointing to something that was very, very important. I think Helms, who was elected 40 years ago, marked a real change in the Senate. Helms's biographer has referred to him as the righteous warrior. And I don't dispute that. I think Helms was not a cynical person. I think he deeply believed in what he was doing. But he was the person who elevated the social issues, particularly the issue of abortion after Roe versus Wade, but other social issues. He elevated that agenda as well as an anti-civil rights agenda. And he also used the Senate as an instrument of obstruction, an instrument of obstruction, and also an instrument to raise issues, to put people on in the position of making difficult votes and then using them for political purposes. Traditionally, senators cast hard votes when they came up, and that was fair game. But Helms used the Senate to bring up votes just to put people on record. Then he became a national fundraiser for the right wing and was quite successful in defeating people. He changed the Senate in a significant way. Interestingly, Bob, there was a notice that Jim DeMint of South Carolina, who is really a lineal descendant of Helms in terms of his approach to the Senate, just announced that he's going to leave the Senate to run the right-wing Heritage Foundation, a think tank. And I think that's a great thing for Heritage. I think it's a great thing for the Senate to be rid of Senator DeMint.
You're listening to Ira Shapiro. He's the author of The Last Great Senate, Courage and Statesmanship in Times of Crisis. Are there any changes in the mechanics of the Senate, the rules of the Senate, that operate so differently today that it's partially accountable for this difficulty of getting to bipartisanship on issues?
This is it's a fundamentally important question, because there are people who say, look, there is no problem with the rules. The problem is with the senators who abuse the rules. From my standpoint, the problem is both. The Senate rules have always been vulnerable to people who would practice obstruction. And in the past, what you had was senators who respected the institution enough that they were able to overcome the things in the rules that would lead to obstruction. So filibusters were rare. Senate holds, quote unquote, holds on nominations or legislation were limited. And what happened now is that all restraint is off, and the rules actually do permit outrageous abuses. And I believe that the rules, in fact, should be changed. I don't think we should wait till the Senate is filled with 100 statesmen and women. We should have rules that actually work fairly, and we don't have them now.
When you look through the roll call of the U.S. Senate during the years you've written about, Humphrey, McGovern, Muskie, Church, Magnuson, Dole, Robert Byrd, so many folks, and then you look today at the roll call, what do you see on both sides of the aisle? Are there a handful anyway? Is there some hope out there for a bright future? What about these recent elections? Anybody you're looking at that might be able to take us back?
I think there is some hope. Actually, I've described myself as more optimistic than a lot of people, and there's several reasons for it. One is, I think the senators themselves who have been there are angry and frustrated that they're failing the country. Not all of them. There are some like DeMint who are total obstructionists, but many of the senators believe that they came to Washington to be part of an institution that makes collective decisions for the national interest, and it's not doing that. So I think that even before the election, they were prepared to sort of try to make the Senate work better. The second thing is, I think the election was an emphatic vote for a lot of Democrats, but also against extremism and against obstruction. And I think the senators that are coming in now, I would say Elizabeth Warren, Tim Kaine, Heidi Heitkamp, there are a number of them that I think have real potential to be part of what I'd like to think of, if not the next great Senate, then at least a respectable one. I'm always asked whether these people are just dwarfs in comparison to the great senators that we grew up with. And I think the senators we grew up with were a remarkable group of men, and they were at that time almost all men. I think they were remarkable. That greatest generation that Tom Brokaw has written about. But I also think there are plenty of capable people in the Senate today who can do the job if they rid themselves of the hyper-partisan Senate model that they're trapped in. They feel trapped in it, or seem to feel trapped in it, and I just don't accept that. I think they have the capacity to do the job, but they need to, frankly, change their leaders who have failed them, change the rules as needed, but above all, stop being partisan operatives.
The other day I was listening to Morning Joe, and they had a good bipartisan group on the show that morning, and they were talking about the president's role in all of this, trying to avoid the fiscal cliff and whether Obama's done enough with Congress and what have you. The moral of the story was, among this very bipartisan crowd, that President Obama is not as good as Lyndon Johnson was, for sure. Maybe nobody ever will be as good as Lyndon Johnson was, in just letting it all out and deferring to the Senate, walking over to the Congress and sitting down and talking to these guys. And Carter might have been the same way. I'm not that familiar with that era. But I guess I just wonder, in your own mind, if this isn't a two-way street a bit, and the president may have to roll up his sleeves a little more than he was willing to do in his first term.
Well, I think the president is rolling up his sleeves a little more. I think that he learned some lessons in the first term, and I think that he will be stronger in terms of his negotiating. We're seeing that already on the question of tax increases on the top 2%. But I also do believe that, and I get asked this a lot, I think that the Senate failed the country and failed President Obama. I think that he was entitled to believe that when he came into office at a moment of absolute national economic crisis, that he would get cooperation from the minority. That's how our system's supposed to work. And he didn't get any from day one. And from my standpoint, that's pretty unpatriotic. Jimmy Carter last year made a statement that Barack Obama was dealing with a lot of the same kind of problems he had dealt with. But Carter, he said, had one advantage. He had a Senate that worked on a bipartisan basis, and Obama didn't.
Some would argue that the leadership is the problem, if we could only get some new leaders in there. And of course, you don't hear the argument much anymore, but a few years ago, folks were talking about term limitation, if not term limitation for members, at least term limitation for leadership. Your thoughts on whether or not that is part of the problem, that we're just putting people back in there who have remained as strident today as they were yesterday?
I always get asked about term limits, and my basic view is I don't really believe in them. I believe in competitive elections. I think for members, and you've made the distinction between leaders and members, I think that's a valuable distinction. For members, I think if you look around, you find in the states that have term limits, a lot of the state legislatures have gotten weaker and weaker because they have no expertise. Look, I think that I wouldn't legislate or have rules that said that people should not be Senate leaders for more than X years, but I do think that the senators ought to give serious thought to whether their leaders are serving them well. I remember the House does rotate chairmanships, and I'm not against that, but I think that basically it comes down to the senators understanding that their current leaders are not serving them well.
Ira, we've run out of time, but what a great opportunity to chat with you about what was a great era in American politics. Again, the name of the book, The Last Great Senate, Courage and Statesmanship in Times of Crisis. Ira Shapiro, thanks for joining us today at Reader's Corner.
Thank you, Bob, and I really appreciated the time to talk.
I hope you enjoyed this encore edition of our interview with Ira Shapiro. Next week, Timothy Egan, author of Short Nights of the Shadow Catcher, The Epic Life and Immortal Photographs of Edward Curtis. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones, research by Mike Journey. Our producer is Janelle Brown. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner.